within the air supplies the cars themselves carried. At the top of the access tunnel, the hatch leading into the shelter had no security lock. A simple spin of a well-oiled wheel opened it easily. Dan felt some puzzlement as he pushed the metal hatch back and climbed up into the shelter. The robots from down below didn't come up here for maintenance work. Would the Yamagata safety people who maintained the cable cars take care of this hatch, too? The shelter reminded him of the old days when construction crews lived in tempos, temporary shelters made of expended spacecraft sections, thin aluminum cylinders that they buried under a few feet of rubble scooped up from the regolith. Life in the tempos had been spare and rugged, no place for a person of delicate sensibilities, or a keen sense of smell, for that matter. Tempos. He had lived in them for nearly 3 years, and here he was back in one. It was a curved roof tempo, sure enough. Almost bare inside, Dan saw in the light of his hand lamp, except for tall, green cylinders of oxygen, a phone console sitting on an otherwise empty desk, a couple of shelves of emergency medical kits and rations, and a quartet of spacesuits, standing stiffly in their racks like knightly armor of old, complete with helmets on shelves above the empty torsos. The first suit he picked had only a quarter of its normal supply of oxygen in its tanks. Annoyed, Dan went to the next suit. Its tanks were dry. "They maintained the damn hatches," he muttered, "but not the suits. That's brilliant." The other two suits were almost empty as well. Fuming now, Dan went to the oxygen cylinders to start refilling one of the suits. They too were low. Each of them was missing from half to three-quarters of its normal capacity. "This is crazy," he said to himself. It was laborious work, even in a low gravity. It took more than an hour for Dan to fill the backpack tank of one of the pressure suits. Then he waited worriedly for 2 hours more, watching the suit's gauges to make certain that the tank did not leak. No leaks, he decided with relief. But then, how did the tanks lose oxy? And the standby cylinders, too. His wait had accomplished another purpose. The sun should have set by now. Checking his wristwatch computer, he found that it was indeed nighttime outside. It would be more difficult for them to spot him out in the open. Not impossible by any means. But the cover of darkness gave him a bit more of an edge. "If I don't break my damned neck out there," he groused. Very carefully, he stepped into the leggings of the suit he had selected and pulled on the thickly insulated boots. Then he wriggled into the hard-shell torso and wormed his arms through the sleeves. Stomping around the cramped shelter, he tested the suit's flexibility. Then he backed into the backpack, still hooked to its rack, and felt its latches click against his suit's fittings. It had been a long time since he'd carried a fully loaded backpack and pressure suit. Even in the moon's gentle gravity, it felt like a ton of dead weight on his shoulders and back. The damned pistol still in the pocket of his coveralls jabbed against his thigh annoyingly. Dan pulled on the suit's gloves and sealed them to the wrist cuffs. He flexed his fingers, thinking, "They haven't made much of an improvement on these things. Feels as stiff as rigor mortis, and the damn suit's not even pressurized yet." Finally, he slid the helmet over his head and sealed it to his collar ring. He pulled the visor down and locked it, then clumped over to the only oxygen cylinder that still had some gas in it. Fitting its extension hose to the port on his suit, he overpressurized his suit until it bulged out like a balloon, making it awkward to move his arms or legs. Then he waited, watching alternately the watch and the pressure gauge on the instrument cluster on the suit's left wrist. With nobody here to check him out, this was the only way to test that the suit was properly sealed and there were no pinhole leaks anywhere. "There are old astronauts and there are bold astronauts," Dan remembered the old saying, "but there are no old, bold astronauts. Haste is the enemy of safety," he knew. At last, satisfied that the suit was tight, he let most of the overpressurizing oxygen hiss out of the port and stepped slowly, like some monster from a horror video, to the airlock of the shelter. It took several minutes for the lock to cycle. Then the indicator light turned red, and Dan slid the outer hatch open. The smooth, gentle slope of Mount Jaeger confronted him. Downslope, he could see the humped mass of rubble that covered Alphonsus City's main plaza. Directly overhead ran the cable car line. His wristwatch tingled against his skin. Glancing at the watch on his suit cuff, Dan realized what the programmed wristwatch was telling him. This was the exact moment of his birth, 50 years ago, precisely. "Happy birthday," Dan muttered as he stepped out onto the glassy, pitted slope of Mount Jaeger. 17. 4 hours later, he was still climbing the tallest mountain of the Alphonsus Ringwall. Sandpapered by eons of micrometeorite infall, most of the moon's mountains looked tired and old. They slumped, rounded and softly curved, their slopes usually very gentle. But the sandpapering had made their slopes very smooth as well, almost glassy. Traction was not easy. Dan was puffing with exertion. Malik was right, he thought. I've let myself get out of shape. Fat and 50, that's me. He stopped and looked downslope toward the floor of Alphonsus. Even though the sun was down, there was seldom true darkness at this latitude. A gibbous earth hung in the black, star-flecked sky, fat and gleaming. Blue seas and white clouds, glowing with life and warmth. Even the night side of earth glittered with lights of cities and highways. There was enough light to see the little pockmarks of mini-craters in the stony ground. Enough light to spot a lone man walking if you knew where to look. Dan doubted that the space station all the way out at the L1 point could pick him up visually, or even in the infrared, and he knew that the satellites orbiting the moon at closer altitudes were not equipped for such detailed surveillance work. "I'll be okay," he told himself. "Unless they pop a surveillance team into an OTV just to look for me. Or maybe send out a cable car full of guys with telescopes. Better get a move on." To where? That had been the first question he had asked himself when he had realized, back on Tetiaroa, that Malik intended to jail him. Where can you go to hide from the Global Economic Council? As one of the richest men in the Earth-Moon system, Dan had always kept a few special hideaways for himself, and a few false identities, so he could travel undetected and undisturbed. But with all his assets confiscated, he was down to the few emergency things he had tucked away in safe deposit vaults in various cities on Earth. For more than 10 years he had played the seemingly pointless game. At times he himself had thought that he was being paranoid, or at least childish. But deep in his gut he had known that power-hungry men like Malik would topple him if they got the chance. Now they had done it, and he was running for his life. To where? The question popped up again to confront him as he slogged upslope, following the cable car line overhead as a rough guide. His immediate goal was another one of those temporary shelters that had been emplaced along the cable line. He worried that the next tempo would be largely gutted of its supplies as the first one had been, or that Kate Williams's team of goons would have figured out where he was going and be there waiting for him. He pushed on. 50 years old, he thought. Some double-damned birthday this is. Some guys retire by the time they're 50, or chuck their careers and start out on something new. He grinned to himself. That's what you're doing, Daniel, old pal. Change of life. Time to start a new career. You're going from being a billionaire to being a penniless fugitive from the law. How's that for progress? Well, he answered himself, maybe this time around I'll figure out what I want to be when I grow up. Feeling strangely cheerful, Dan trudged on up the slick, almost slippery face of the mountain. He stumbled here and there. Once he slid on his rump for nearly 30 yards, stopped only by the rim of a new-looking crater. Sitting there, helmet visor fogged with his ragged breath, peering down into the shadowed depths of the crater, he realized that sizable meteoroids still struck the moon with some regularity. That would be the icing on the cake, to get killed by a meteoroid. God's sniper. He laughed and clambered laboriously to his booted feet once again. At least, he told himself, you can make yourself a moving target. I panicked, he admitted. I panicked and ran. But what alternative did I have? Once Scarlet's goons had me in their grip, they weren't going to let me go. Whether Malik sent me to Tetiaroa or Devil's Island, I'd be tucked away someplace where I'd never get out. I had to run. Or end up in the penal colony at Aristarchus. Shouldn't have come back to the moon. That was my big mistake. You can get around on Earth. 12 billion people down there. Not even the GEC can keep track of all of them. I could have